What begins at the bottom of these stairs is a journey through the life of the Museo Galileo, a century-long story intertwined with countless others, with those of his directors, the city of Florence, the history of Italy and the world, and also with my own life, which today turns 100 years old, like this museum. When you hear the first notes of music, start heading down the stairs. I'll be waiting for you there. The first scientific museum in Europe open to the public was founded by the Grand Duke of Tuscany, Pietro Leopoldo. It was called the Royal Museum of Physics and Natural History. That was in 1775, and I wasn't born yet. In fact, my birth was still exactly 150 years away. I was born on the 7th of May 1925 at the Santa Maria Nuova Hospital, right here in the heart of Florence. That very day, near that same hospital, a new cultural institution was also born, one that would carry on the legacy of Pietro Leopoldo's museum. It was the Institute for the History of Science, founded by a physician named Andrea Corsini, who had a dream to create the finest institute and the most beautiful museum of history of science in the world. His goal was to unite scientific instruments from centuries past collected by the Grand Dukes of Tuscany with the equally ancient books that had once belonged to those same princes. Look at them in the display case, books that, even after centuries, retain all their elegance. Their precious bindings and the Medici family crest, painted in color or embossed in gold on their covers. How do I know all this when in May of 1925 I was only a few moments old? I'll tell you as you continue into the next room with your journey in this museum story. A story that, as I came to learn, would deeply intertwine with my own. Because while I was just taking my first steps into the world, piecing syllables together to shape my first words, something remarkable was about to happen in Florence. It was May 8th, 1929, the day after my 4th birthday, and my father gifted me a ticket to the first National Exhibition of History of Science. He had always been passionate about astronomy. Back then, when the city lights were not as many nor as strong as they are today, he would spend new moon nights on our rooftop terrace, gazing at the sky. It's not enough to just look. You have to look with eyes that want to see, that believe in what they see, he used to say, quoting his hero, Galileo. That's why he gave me those tickets to that first National Exhibition of History of Science, held here in Florence in that May of 1929. He wanted to nurture in me that same desire, that urge to see, to observe the world, to introduce me to the objects and the instruments that scientists and inventors had imagined and created over the centuries. A heritage that was in danger because, as Andrea Corsini, one of the exhibition creators, said, in Italy, no one was taking care of inventors, scientists, instruments. They lay neglected and forgotten in attics and basements, deteriorating. That day at the National Exhibition is the oldest memory I have, and one of the most extraordinary. Maybe because I was just a child, maybe because I'd never seen so many people gathered in one place before, maybe because of the incredible variety of objects and instruments that passed before my astonished eyes that morning. Over 10,000 of them from every region of Italy. Everything humanity had invented from antiquity onward, now for the first time saved, catalogued, and exhibited to the public. My father must have stood at least 30 minutes in front of the case, holding one of the only telescopes by Galileo that have survived to this day. As for me, I was completely captivated by a much smaller instrument made of such a bright brass it looked like gold, a solar microscope. Shiny and gleaming like the one you can admire here in this room. A little tube like a telescope at one end and a small rectangular mirror at the other. The sun rays strike the mirror and are reflected into the tube, which projects an enlarged image of whatever is placed on the microscope glass, like a slide projector. There are more stories I would like to tell you in this room. As you listen, take your time to look at the other objects and books on display. -50 degree thermometers. Spiral thermometer. Surgical tools for amputation. Weighing scale. Drum electrostatic machine. Box of mathematical instruments. How did the instruments and books first shown in that May of 1929 end up here, within these walls? The answer is simple. The success of the National Exhibition, which drew over 100,000 visitors, sparked the idea that such an extraordinary event could become something more permanent, something stable, a real institution. So the Institute for the History of Science received from the University of Florence the extensive collection of books and scientific instruments once belonged to the Royal Museum. and a small institute moved in this historic building where you are standing now, by the river, at number 1 Piazza dei Giudici, and became the institute and the museum of the history of science. That was in 1930, and as fate would have it, my father and I moved to at number 2 Piazza dei Giudici. And that's how this museum became my second home. The year 1930 and the decade that followed were not happy years for our country. But they were at least years of peace, and I had a peaceful childhood. Cars were rare in town, and I could play in Piazza dei Giudici every time I was not at school. The museum didn't receive many visitors yet. Tourists preferred to wander through the more famous Uffizi Gallery, and in the quiet of the square, I gradually came to know everyone who walked behind these walls. First the doorman and the guards, and eventually the director himself, Andrea Corsini. One afternoon, that big man with the dark mustache personally took me on a tour of these rooms. And on that occasion, he told me about his dream: to create here the finest institute and the most beautiful museum of history of science in the world. Then, leaning down toward me, he asked, "And what's your dream?" My gaze gently wandered over the instruments around me. "To become an inventor," I answered. "Well then," he said, "consider this building your home." And from that moment on, I began calling the museum my second home. I saw Corsini again many times after that. I remember it well, December 1942. War had broken out, and people had stopped smiling so easily. That cold morning, a few trucks pulled into the square to save the museum's instruments from the bombings. Workers were loading small and large wooden crates, and he stood outside the entrance. Right out there. He spotted me and called out, "Hey, inventor, come here." Beside him stood a woman, almost as tall as he was, in her 20s. "This is Miss Maria Luisa Bonelli," he said. "She's in charge of cataloging and restoring the objects we have inside." Then he added, "She's your neighbor too." I shook her hand shyly. Back then, there were not many women in such important roles, and I couldn't have imagined how essential that young woman would become for the survival of the museum where you are standing today, my second home. But I tell you more about that soon. Before continuing on to the next room, there's one last story I want to tell you. It was the summer of 1944, the fifth and the final summer of the war, the one that could have been the last season of life for the museum. In the city, we were exhausted by the fighting, by hunger. The Anglo-Americans were at the gates. As they fled north, the Germans were placing explosive charges on the pillars of the bridges along the Arno. On the morning of August 3rd, a curfew was declared, and despite the suffocating heat, my father and I barricaded inside the house. When night fell, Florence was cloaked in an unreal silence. Time itself seemed to have stopped. Until the air was shattered by a first explosion, then another, and another one. The city's bridges were being blown up one by one. After dawn had brought the final blast, my father and I decided to step outside. The air was thick with smoke. Stones and rubble from the destroyed bridges were everywhere. Only Ponte Vecchio was still standing. I lifted my gaze toward the museum. The windows were shattered by the shock wave from the explosions, but my second home was still there. Peace would finally return, and the Museum of History of Science, with its books and instruments, had survived the war, almost unharmed. That day, I let out a long breath of relief, and I believe you would have done the same. It was time to get moving again, to rebuild the city. And now, you too can continue on your path. Go through the door and turn right. New wonders await in the next room. In 1947, I went to hear my very first concert at Palazzo Strozzi. There was a German-born American pianist. Stefan Bardas was his name. He performed the etude from Chopin's Opus 25, which until then I had only heard on the radio. I had always liked Chopin, and that evening I liked him even more. The concert was meant to raise funds for the restoration of the museum, which was still damaged even though it had reopened right after the war, and the costs were high. A few years later, during one of my visits, I saw Corsini's young assistant again, Maria Luisa. She still remembered me. She told me to call her by her name and showed me a book that struck me deeply. The same one that is in front of you, just now. L'Astrologia, the Astrology, by Ottavio Pisani, printed in Antwerp, Belgium, in 1613, over 400 years ago. A unique work filled with hand-colored illustrations, like the one showing the terrestrial globe with the constellation of Aries and Atlas, the Titan who, according to Greek mythology, bears the weight of the entire sky on his shoulders. But the book is also full of moving parts and rotating discs, an animated book. Maria Luisa told me the story of how this volume, in that distant year of 1613, had taken 6 full months to reach Florence from Antwerp. It arrived at the Medici court soaked with rain, and it required an extraordinary effort to bring it back to life. Pisani dedicated the work to the Grand Duke Cosimo II de' Medici and did everything he could to get a payment from the man he called Your Most Serene Highness, hoping it would cover the cost of printing and the many years of work he had poured into it. But in the end, he died without a single penny for it. And even now, the open hands of Atlas on this page seem to renew his plea 4 centuries later. L'Astrologia by Ottavio Pisani is one of the reasons I speak of wonders when I talk about the books and the instruments kept in this place. Irrepressible, spectacular works. Another one is right behind you in the lit-up case in the wall near the stairs. Step closer, have a better look. In 1764, 150 years after Ottavio Pisani's astrology, the German inventor and clockmaker Friedrich von Knaus built the machine you are now looking at, the writing hand. An automaton that hides a complex system of gears, springs, and levers inside its silver-plated copper shell. Once properly adjusted, the little pen dips into ink, and the hand would be able to write anything, if its maker had not chosen to program it with just one phrase, which is traced here. To this house may God grant neither limits of time nor space. A wish and a dedication to the house of Habsburg-Lorraine, who had ruled over the Grand Duchy of Tuscany since 1737, after the Medici. Machines like this one were very popular in the 18th century. They used to amaze the great noble courts of Europe. These automata could write, draw, and play musical instruments. But mechanisms like the writing hand are rarer than rare. Every screw has to be tightened just right, for the mechanism not to jam, for the pen to rise and lower as the ink curves and glides smoothly across the paper without hesitation. And that's how my life flowed from the end of the war onward, smooth and steady, like the working of an automaton, like the gears of the clocks my father used to repair in his little shop, our bottega along the Arno, studying, helping out my father in the family workshop. The only stirrings in that perfect mechanism came from emotions, rare as they were, love now and then, and also good or bad news from the museum, my second home. The news of Andrea Corsini's death in 1961 brought back the memory of my visit with him to these rooms 30 years earlier. But I was glad to know the museum had passed into good hands. Those of Maria Luisa Bonelli, whom I had met, still young, during the war years. Then came 1966, and everything changed. On November 3rd of 1966, it had already been raining for days in Florence. With my father, who was no longer young, we had decided that we would not open the bottega the next day. The river level kept rising, and so did our worry. But we never could have imagined the terrible sight that appeared before us the following dawn. Around 5 in the morning, on November 4th, the Arno, enormously swollen by then, broke its banks at Ponte alle Grazie. In an instant, the water came all the way here. It flooded the square, burst through the doors and the ground floors, the stairwells down to the basements, turned into waterfalls, and whoever could began to scramble upstairs. I woke up my father, grabbed a few things, 2 blankets, a radio, and we made our way to the attic. You should get moving too. Retrace your steps and head to the next room on your left.
È uno spettacolo allucinante e doloroso. La piena d'acqua non accenna a diminuire.
The rain showed no sign of letting up.
Da stamane Firenze è isolata. L'Arno, straripato in più punti, divide in 2 la città.
The water had already filled the basements and it kept rising inch by inch, flooding the ground floors.
Se apro una finestra, tanto per dare l'impressione di che cosa c'è sotto di noi, se si sente il rumore, ecco. Non so se vi giunge questo rumore.
At one point we saw a window on the first floor of the museum swing open, and suddenly Maria Luisa appears, desperate, calling for help. Then the window shuts again, and nothing. Just the sound of rushing water.
Ore 12, l'acqua è giunta in Piazza del Duomo, tutto il centro storico è paralizzato, l'acqua cresce per le strade.
The next day we would learn that to save the most precious objects, director Maria Luisa Bonelli had climbed up to the first floor, exited through a window onto the narrow ledge facing the Uffizi, and walked that ledge, just a few inches wide, all the way to the building next door. She broke a window and entered, carrying with her Galileo's telescopes.
Ore 12:15, via Panzani, via Cerretani, via Martelli, via dei Pecori, piazza Strozzi, laghi che rigurgitano, torrenti impazziti.
Questo non è un fiume, è la via Cerretani, è la via Panzani, è il cuore di Firenze, invasa dall'acqua.
Over those long hours of flooding, Maria Luisa did not just save the telescopes. She went back and forth, rescuing astrolabes, celestial globes, and a number of other instruments.
Ore 13, c'è uno sprazzo di nuvole chiare, forse cesta di piovere, 1900 metri cubi d'acqua al minuto, questa è la forza della piena. Dalla prefettura il collega Bellucci ci fa sapere che i ponti resistono, le spallette dei Lungarni anche, ma la città in quel punto è sommersa.
My father explained to me that in the past, Palazzo Castellani, the building that houses the museum had already seen its wall facing the Arno collapse under the force of the current. So I guess that must have been Bonelli's greatest fear, the collapse of the building, or part of it, and the loss of the museum's entire collection. A tragedy.
L'impeto dell'alluvione è tale che non si può portare soccorso. Luce e acqua potabile mancano.
We need water and food. We tear up a white sheet and hang it out the window. Outside, just the roaring sound of water and the wind against the glass.
Ore 15. Abbiamo passato un paio d'ore d'angoscia. L'acqua continua purtroppo ad aumentare. Alle finestre qua e là sventolano drappi bianchi. Paura o effettivo bisogno di aiuto?
Evening arrives slowly. Calm comes only after darkness. It's around 8 p.m. when the Arno slowly returns to its banks. The power is out, the city is silent, the atmosphere desolate. The next morning, I managed to get out in the street, and just like on the dawn of August 4th, 1944, I saw the full extent of the disaster. This time, there were no stones or rubble in the streets, but Piazza dei Giudici was covered in a thick layer of mud and stones that the river had left behind. On the walls of the buildings, the mark of the flood. 13 feet, 8 inches above ground level. The Arno, like a wall. The Museum of History of Science, though, was safe, not only because the river had finally relented, but also thanks to the courage of this director, Maria Luisa Bonelli, who had risked her life to protect its treasures. Like Penelope weaving her unraveled web, Florence began to rebuild, and so did this museum. Once again, we had to roll up our sleeves and repair the damage. It would take years, like Forti's book, L'Anatomia Universale, The Universal Anatomy by Paolo Mascagni, printed in 1833, kept on the ground floor of the museum and completely submerged in mud. We thought it would be last forever, and yet, 50 years later, here it is, fully restored. But such great traumas also leave permanent scars, and not everything went back to how it used to be. Beneath the mud of November 4th, unique pieces disappeared forever. Books, chemical instruments, and acoustic devices. And in town, too, many botteghe never opened again. My father's shop was one of them. It was completely submerged by the force of the river. He chose to close its doors for good and spent the rest of his life watching the stars at night and during the day helping restore the antique clocks rescued from the Arno's mud. he also took part in cleaning and restoring the instruments of this museum, and so did I. It made me happy, because for the first time, I felt I could finally do something useful for what had been my second home for 30 years. And so, with these scars in the body and this joy in the heart, it's time to move to the final stop of our journey. Go through the door toward the next room. Once you are inside, don't go straight to the glass case in front of you. Look at the one on your left, the one with the Sidereus Nuncius. It's one of Galileo's most famous books, containing the results of his telescope observations from 1609. A book just over 60 pages long, and yet revolutionary, because, as Galileo himself writes, "Truly great are the things which in this small book I set forth for the students of nature to contemplate." And among the students of nature, I like to include all those who, like my father, have spent sleepless nights staring at the sky through a telescope to see Jupiter and its moons, the Pleiades, or the moon with its seas, mountains, and craters, just as Galileo saw them that autumn of 1609. Breath-stealing visions captured in the first realistic drawings ever made of the moon's surface, drawings that are now here before our eyes. The moon, boundless, when it was full, it felt like it might crush us. When it was new, it rolled through the sky like a black umbrella blown by the wind. And the crescent moon came forward with such low horns, it looked as if it would pierce the ridge of a promontory and get stuck there. That's how Calvino describes it in his Cosmic Comics, and that's just how I have always pictured it above Galileo's head, and how I still like to imagine it when I look up at the sky and see the moon gibbous, just like in those illustrations from 400 years ago. Now that my eyesight is clouded with age and the stars are harder to see through the city lights, looking at the moon takes me back to my childhood. I think of my father gazing up at the night sky, and of Galileo's telescope that left him spellbound at the 1929 exhibition. And I think of this scientist from Pisa who in 1633 was put on trial for the theories he wrote in a book, the same one sitting in the case to your right, the dialogue concerning the two chief world systems. An astronomical treatise presented to the reader in the form of a dialogue between three characters. Not the three great thinkers you see in the illustration here, Aristotle on the left, Ptolemy in the center, and Copernicus on the right, but rather two scientists and a wealthy Venetian, Salviati, Simplicio, and Sagredo, a work in which Galileo offers proof of the Copernican hypothesis, an Earth no longer at the center of the universe. An unfortunate dialogue, as he called it in a letter to the jurist Elia Diodati, unfortunate because it led him to trial before the Inquisition and to pronounce a humiliating abjuration in which he would renounce his theories as heresies. And yet Galileo was a turning point. From that moment on, humanity began to look at the sky differently. But for me and my father, he was also a pillar of our family story. That's why it meant so much to learn that in 2010, nearly 90 years after its founding, this museum, my second home, would finally take his name, becoming the Museo Galileo. Starting from the 1980s, the museum began to change once again. The number of visitors kept growing, and after the death of the beloved Maria Luisa Bonelli, a new director arrived, Paolo Galluzzi. New horizons opened up. Beautiful exhibitions were created in Florence, and from here they traveled far and wide. Little by little, this place became more and more of a cultural landmark for Florence, for Italy, and for the world. Pause for a moment in front of the case dedicated to the extraordinary Dome of Santa Maria del Fiore, built by Brunelleschi, the centerpiece of an exhibition on Renaissance engineers that reached four continents, from Beijing to Tunis, from Paris to New York. As you walk on, you'll find 17th century atlases commissioned by the Medici family, with drawings of ancient sailing ships and fantastical sea creatures. And on the opposite side of the room, you'll see a gargling fountain with a little bird that chirps. A working reconstruction of an ingenious device designed by Hero of Alexandria, a first century engineer. There's no hidden motor, just water and air creating this magic. Thanks to these exhibitions, the beauty of the history of science spread from Florence to the world. And I had the privilege of seeing it all just by stepping outside my front door and crossing the street. That's how my mind kept dreaming, and how I grew older more gently. From my little house on Piazza dei Giudici, where I now lived alone, I watched the lines of visitors grow thicker, from a few thousand to tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands. Italians and foreigners from every corner of the world, dotting old science lovers like me, and school children on field trips who feel a bit like the grandchildren I never had. Today my hair is white, and my eyes are tired. And though the dream I once shared with Andrea Corsini of becoming an inventor never came true, I fulfilled another one, a quieter one, to be, for a day, a guide in this museum. To inspire in others the same passion for science that my father, Andrea Corsini, Maria Luisa Bonelli, and Paolo Galluzzi once gifted me, walking with me through these rooms and corridors of my second home. The director's dream was to make this place the finest institute and the most beautiful museum of history of science in the world. My dream was to tell you this story, to bring you here in front of these books and illustrations, to let you gaze at an automaton or a solar microscope, and share my sense of wonder, the very same feeling that students and teachers still feel today, walking through these halls for the first time. The same awe I felt back in 1929, when I first laid eyes on the telescope Galileo used to observe the moon 4 centuries ago. That telescope I have told you so much about, and which you haven't seen yet, because it's not part of this exhibition. You'll find it upstairs, along with many other unique and marvelous instruments that, just a bit of advice from an old man, you really should go see. Galileo's telescopes are displayed on the first floor in the room dedicated to the scientists from Pisa. They came here after having been kept for many years in the first scientific museum in Europe open to the public, a sort of grandfather to this very institute. That museum was called the Royal Museum of Physics and Natural History, and it opened in 1775, when I was not born yet. I was born on May 7th, 1925, 100 years ago, just like this museum, this second home of mine, where today I have welcomed you.
"100 Years of History of Science in Florence" is an exhibition of the Museo Galileo. Audio guide created by Collettivo Panotti, with the voice of David Riondino. Written by Marco Stefanelli. Montage by Irene Dani. Original music by Giulio Vannuzzi. Editing and production by Alexandra Genzini.